Okay. So just a few things to say before we get into the talk. So yeah, I just want to express a gratitude to all of you for the commitment and practice of silence. It's really been quite exceptional so far on this retreat, I have to say. Maybe I just haven't been in the wrong place at the wrong time, but when I can nap through the afternoon without being disturbed, that's a good sign. Thank you. So we can keep supporting a deepening silence as we enter into the middle of the retreat. One way that I like to think of this as well is that we are protectors of each other's silence. So we're not just in silence for ourselves, but we're also holding that space for each other. What a lovely thing to do collectively. And then another thing to say is this ties into the talk I'm going to be giving this morning on karma. So we really want you to do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself on this retreat, and that may mean not coming to some sessions in the Shrine Room because you need to rest or you need to exercise or something else needs to happen for you to be able to show up fully for yourself. So please do that. And the rest of us who are in the Shrine Room will know, if you're not here, that you're taking care of yourself. So in a way, you're still showing up, but maybe just somewhere in a different space. And we want you to make those choices quite consciously. And just watch out if that choice might be coming from a resistance to going deeper in your practice. And then maybe the choice is to actually just show up in the Shrine Room. So you're going to have to negotiate that for yourself. Or you could talk to your meditation review or about it. Does that make sense? Okay, so I was trying to think of a sexier name for this talk, but it just kept wanting to be What We Do Matters. What We Do Matters. Which I know sounds kind of obvious, but I can just speak for myself that I don't really take that on board a lot of the time, that what I do matters. And maybe a further iteration of that would be, it matters that what we do matters. It matters that what we do matters. So I'm going to be this is a slightly idiosyncratic talk. I tried to organize it, but it was a bit unruly. It wanted to do its own thing. So the general direction of travel is I'm going to take us imaginatively from sort of where we've come from to where we are to where we're going from the point of view of karma. And I'm going to be doing that from like kind of the largest, most macro perspective down to the most infinitesimal, I can never say that word, perspective, yeah? So macro to micro. And we'll start with this, and I'll also be sharing some personal stories. I'll be bringing Bhante in quite a lot because he's around quite a bit just now. He's on the shrine. He's just passed. He's very present in our minds. So I've been reflecting quite a bit on the times I have spoken with him about my practice and the things that he said to me. So I'll bring in a couple of those stories, and there'll be some quotes as well. So we'll start with this beautiful poem from Rebecca Elson, a Canadian astronomer who died quite young of cancer. She died in her early 40s. It's an extraordinary life if you're interested and want to learn more about her. We are survivors of immeasurable events flung upon some reach of land, small wet miracles without instructions, only the imperative of change. We are survivors of immeasurable events flung upon some reach of land, small wet miracles without instructions, only the imperative of change.
Excuse me, who was that?
Rebecca Elson. I think only an astronomer could have written that poem. So it's like, you know, we've all heard it. We're made of stardust. You know, everything that was present at the time that the universe started, whenever that was, however that happened, is present now and is part of us. Flung upon some reach of land, you know, we don't get to choose where we're born. And, you know, just echoing back to the first talk on the preciousness of human birth, you know, just the fact that we're part of the very small minority of human beings that are born in a place where we can actually practice the Dharma is magnificent. And I think the mothers in the room will appreciate the small wet miracles without instructions. And then we just, yeah, all there is change. It's an imperative. So what are we going to do about that? Are we going to work in alignment with that, or are we going to resist it all the way? So isn't it incredible that we're here? And we can think also, we can call to mind the ancestors. So think of all the events that had to transpire for you to be born, and all the people that had to be born themselves, live their lives, suffer, make love, raise children of their own, die, build the world that we now inhabit. Until one day we arrived. And then think about all the events that have also shaped who you are and that have resulted in exactly how you are manifesting just now. There's a lot there, immeasurable. And I often think about this because I'm a daughter of immigrants, so my parents immigrated to Boston from Chile in the 70s. They were escaping political unrest in their home country. So I often think, because the narrative in our family was, when we go back to Chile, mm-hmm. when we go back. So there was always this sense of, I could never really settle because there was always a sense that we were gonna go back. And then my mom got sick and died of cancer and we didn't go back. My dad remarried an American woman and then we were stuck in America. which for me ended up being quite a good thing. Because I was gay, and actually having to come to terms with that in the Chilean culture would have been a lot harder. I don't know if I would have managed. So I often think about what my life would have been like if we had gone back. I would be probably quite a different person than I am today. I may not have found the Dharma. I may not have had the courage to come out. So we can also reflect on that ourselves. Yeah, what are the unique conditions that have given rise to our life. So how we are manifesting right now, physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually, is the sum total of all of our past conditioning. So it's worth reflecting on the fact that our conditioning is all ours. Nobody else has the exact unique concoction of events that you have. It doesn't belong to anyone else. It only belongs to you. And it is your starting point. In any moment, how you are manifesting right now is your starting point. Or as Lama Govinda, who is a contemporary of Bhante's, might say, it's the raw material. Our conditioning is the raw material that we practice with, that perhaps through some alchemical process, we turn to gold, yeah? And how we choose to work with that raw material is up to us. So we've got lots of different tools and practices we can choose from. There's that lovely description of the path as, you know, 10,000 dharmas. There's 10,000 different ways to practice the Dharma. And that's just sort of a placeholder, actually, for as many beings as there are, there's that many different ways to apply the Dharma, because, again, our conditioning is unique. So the principles might be the same, but the sort of way we organize ourselves and also the way we wake up will be unique to us. So this is from the Chinese nun Ikkyu. don't worry, please. Please, how many times do I have to say it? There's no way not to be who you are and where. Don't worry, please, please, how many times do I have to say it? There's no way not to be who you are and where. So we're showing up just as we are, and we found the Dharma. So our practice just now is about bringing those two things more and more into alignment. How we're showing up and our practice. How are we meeting what's showing up? How are we working with it to transform ourselves towards awakening? So throughout this talk, I'm going to be dropping in reflection questions, but I'm not going to leave space for you to reflect just now because you've got the rest of the retreat to reflect. And I've got a lot to say, but I'm just going to give them to you and you can have them, yeah, and then use them whenever. So reflection question, what is my unique conditioning? What is my unique conditioning? How is it showing up on this retreat? What is my unique conditioning? How is it showing up on this retreat? How might I meet it? How might I meet it with curiosity, appreciation?
Can you go a bit slower? What?
Yeah, sorry. How might I meet it with curiosity, appreciation, and love? How might I meet it with curiosity, appreciation, and love? You might be wondering when I'm going to get to karma. I'm filling in gap. Like I'm sort of getting us there through some foundational stuff, yeah. So we'll get there. So grounding in our experience. So it's important to remember that faith in the Dharma is inseparable from faith in ourselves. Faith in the Dharma is inseparable from faith in ourselves. The Dharma is not realized through any other means, but by our own efforts. By our own efforts alone. So it's not enough to believe that all things are impermanent. Oh yeah, all things are impermanent. You know, you're just slapping the impermanence post-it on everything. It's not enough just to believe that all things are impermanent if we don't also believe that we can change. And that we can actually have an effect on how we change. We can make choices that impact how we change. So one of my favorite quotes from Bhante is about the path being a symbol. So he said that the path isn't something out there. It's not like we come across the Dharma and someone opens a door and there's the path and we start walking down it. It's not like that. It's not out there. It's in here. And Bhante went even as far as to say, we are the path. We are the path. So he said, the path is a symbol representing the fact that we can change. The path itself is not out there, it is in here. The path simply represents the individual solution to your own particular predicament. If you know and understand yourself as you are now, that puts you in a position to develop in your own way. The path is you in the process of organizing your mental states in such a way that growth and development will take place in a positive direction. It sounds very simple, doesn't it? Oh, okay, let's just organize our mental states. You know, get in there with some post-its and file folders and... I came across it actually in the Essential Sangharakshita, but I don't know what the original lecture is, sorry. It's probably in What is the Dharma as well, I would guess.
So the path is, can I just repeat?
Yeah.
The path have is the individual solution to your own predicaments.
Yeah, to your own personal predicament.
To your own personal predicament.
To your own particular predicament.
Particular.
Yeah. So you have a problem that's all yours.
Thank you.
The great American folk singer, she's got a line, Annie DeFranco, she's got a line in one of her songs, "I'm the queen of my own compost heap." Yeah, we can all be queens of our own compost heaps. So having confidence in ourselves also means having means trusting in the ground of our conditioning, especially the hard stuff, the stuff we don't want to know about or look at. So having confidence in ourselves means trusting in the ground of our conditioning. And some of you might be familiar with the positive nidana chain. So we've got the will of life, and then we've got feeling, and then there's a gap before craving. And in that gap, we can step onto the positive nidana chain. So making conditioning work for us. And the very first step is to recognize suffering. And from that arises faith. So in dependence upon turning towards our suffering arises faith. So having confidence in the ground of our experience and conditioning, faith arises. So I just want to make this point again. So it's not enough simply to tell ourselves that all things are impermanent or that everything is ultimately empty. We have to actually experience that. We have to know it fully and completely in the core of our being. And the only way to do that is to live through it. You know, there's that beautiful Rilke quote in Art of Reflection that Ratnaguna pulls out, you know, live the questions into the answer, live life through to the answer. I can't remember the exact quote. We have to allow our hearts to be broken right open so that something else can emerge. You know, there's that beautiful image of Avalokiteshvara's head just exploding when he realizes that suffering is endless. We have to have the emotional equivalent, as Kamisuri was saying yesterday. So otherwise, we risk a kind of spiritual bypassing. It's like, oh yeah, yeah, I know, everything's empty. It's like, actually, have we really seen that? Have we really felt that and known that? So it's important and worth remembering the two truths. I find this very, very helpful when I tend towards getting into just telling myself stories about how everything is when I don't really know. So there's the relative truth and the absolute. So although we may get glimpses of the absolute from time to time, we may get glimpses of emptiness or freedom from suffering, we can't forget that there's still a great deal of work to do on the relative level where suffering is still taking place. If not for us, for others, there's still suffering. So Padmasambhava understood this when he said, "My vision is as vast as the clear blue sky, and my conduct is as fine as grains of barley flour." Or more essentially put, ascend with the view, descend with the conduct. So keep going. Yeah, keep opening to emptiness. That's fantastic. Don't forget this muddy, dirty place that we call home, where there's being suffering. So another reflection question. What aspects of the Dharma have I accepted intellectually? What aspects of the Dharma have I accepted intellectually that are longing for a deeper relationship with me?
Can you repeat it, please?
What aspects of the Dharma have I accepted intellectually that are longing for a deeper relationship with me? that wants to come in much closer, to be known through our unique understanding, through our unique conditioning. So I'll give you a very personal example. Impermanence. When your mother dies at the age of 43 and you're 16, you cannot not know impermanence. Impermanence just goes right in and sits with you until you're, and it's very, very painful until you're willing to turn and face that and be with that. And I spent a long time turning away from that, self-medicating with drugs and alcohol, treating myself and everyone around me like shit. And then I decided I needed to do something else. And I turned towards it and I saw impermanence. It was longing for me to relate to it, to be with it, really be with it, not just placate it. So what aspects of the Dharma have I accepted intellectually that are longing for a deeper relationship with me? Okay, how are we doing? Can you take more?
Yeah.
Okay, because I got a few more things to say. So we're going to talk about karma now. I've been talking about karma, but now I'm going to really like specifically talk about karma, particularly how it works. So how karma works. What is karma? So the most simple definition is just action. Karma is action. Actions of body, speech, and mind. Om Ahum. Often the word karma is interchanged with the law of karma, which is a bit more, has a bit more to say. So the law of karma works within the laws of conditionality, Pratichit Samapada, in that how we experience ourselves, others, and the world is shaped by our views, which underpin what we have thought, said, and done in the past, and will shape our future. How we experience ourselves, others, and the world is shaped by our views. So our views shape our experience and create thoughts, words, and deeds that will also shape our future. So what's arriving now is shaped by what we've done in the past. What's coming in the future is shaped by what we do now. The fruit of our karma, if you're a Pali geek, is vipaka. So together we can understand our actions and what they have given, are giving, and will give rise to as our karma vipaka. Action and fruit. Cause, effect. Karma vipaka. Is that clear? It's easy to understand intellectually. Okay, so I'm just going to give you some tuning up around the Dharma here, just so we are perfectly clear. So karma is not interchangeable with conditionality. It's one way in which conditionality works. It's one example of pratichitasamutpada, dependent origination. It's how our mind and mental events condition our experience of the world. But it's important to note that not everything that happens to us is a result of our karma. So we are also conditioned by the physical world around us, our body, our psychological makeup, and the transcendental. So those four things, the physical world around us, our body, our psychological makeup, and the transcendental, along with karma, make up the five niyamas, which come from Buddha Ghosha, and which Bhante has, I think, more than most Western teachers really picked up on and made a big point around. He understood we needed to really get this because the word karma was being bandied about to mean everything. You know, you get hit by a bus, oh, it's your karma. You get backed into by a lorry, it's your karma. What did you do, Sujata?
Can you just go over the five names?
Yeah, sure. So the physical world in which we exist. So organic matter, what's around us, what's even within us. The physical body, so how the body is manifesting. So our psychological makeup. And the transcendental, or Dharma Niyama. Which you could say, you know, like I would guess that everyone in this room has probably had a glimpse of the transcendental, just like a moment where you had a sense of something else. There must be something else, you know. Otherwise, you wouldn't have come along. Yeah. So it's not really a talk on the on karma without reading the verses from the Dhammapada, so let's have them. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow that never departs. So Bhante has said that causality is a complex web. So one thing that I find very useful, particularly in the meditative process, is not to worry too much or get caught up in why something is happening. So I'm not saying that that's not useful. So like, for example, the therapeutic process can be very helpful to help us to understand our conditioning. But we can never parse it all out. We'll never know. We'll never get down to the bottom of it. So yeah, so I find it useful just to remember that when I start to get caught up in the why. And I think it's also important to notice if there's any parts of ourselves that want to blame us for what's happening. I'm not saying that we shouldn't take responsibility, and I'm going to say more about responsibility later, but blaming ourselves for what's arising in our experience is completely unhelpful. Particularly if what's arising is fear or anxiety. And I'm not saying that that's not down to our karma, so it could be that, yeah, there has been some ways in which we've behaved in the past that give rise to fear and anxiety. But it is also very, very important to remember that biologically we are just hardwired to be more vigilant to threat. That is how we are hardwired. So fear and anxiety will come up, and they'll come up in the process of waking up. It's unavoidable because we're edging into the unknown, which, that again, that's what we're hardwired to be afraid of. So I have also found this very, very helpful to know this, and neuroscience is now backing this up. So we can let ourselves off the hook of it, like, oh, I'm just built like this, actually. And I'm built like this, actually, because that's how all my ancestors survived. That's how I got here, actually. It's been helpful. They didn't get eaten by saber-toothed tigers in the brush because they could hear the rustling and they got afraid. And then the adrenaline came and they could run. So unfortunately, for some of us in the modern day, based on what has happened to us in the past, like trauma, for example, can create a hypervigilance that we then have to learn how to work with. And again, there's different therapies out there. There's lots of options out there to help us around that. And I'd encourage you to look for those additional supports to your practice, to not assume that meditation alone necessarily can support us to address everything that's arising. But the important thing to say is it's not our fault, so we don't have to blame ourselves.
So how do you work with this hypervigilance then?
I'm going to ask you to hold that question for now. Yeah, because we can get into that. What we're going to do later today in the second half of the morning is more meditative, and also this evening. So I'll be doing some real input around how to work in your meditation. So I just want to say a bit more about the meditative process and what I have found useful. So what's most important in that process is that we start to bring awareness to what's coming. So rather than worrying about the why, we're more interested in the what is arising and how is it arising. What is actually happening in our direct experience? And a good example of this could be, for example, anger. So if you become aware in meditation that anger is arising, the habitual thing would be to get into the story, yeah? And the process of bringing awareness to it is to just acknowledge, oh, anger. That is what is here now. How is it? So for me, it's hot. It moves upward. It's very uncomfortable to begin with, and then sometimes quite blissful if I'm able to let go of the story. And it can bring a lot of clarity if I'm able to bear with it. So the Buddha was very practical. He saw clearly that what we do and how we are with what is arising in the moment conditions the next moment. So what we do, how we are with what's arising, how we meet what's arising conditions the next moment. And I think this really boils down to two choices. We have two choices. And again, those choices are totally yours to make. We can either turn towards what is here, learn to meet it with awareness, love, curiosity, and a clear intention to transform it. So that's one option. And that could take years and include lots of different strategies. So I'm not talking about just in one moment we turn towards and resolve everything. In fact, we don't get to curate our awakening. You know, we might want to line it all up like ducks in a row, but it's going to unfold in its own mysterious and sometimes deeply frustrating way. But that's the choice. Is there a general direction, you know, the tree bending towards the east, turning towards meeting it with love, awareness, curiosity, and a clear intention to transform? The other choice is basically what we have been doing up until that moment of awareness. Cling to, push away, or ignore it, and continue to wear down the grooves of our samskaras even more deeply. Samskaras meaning habits. So this movement of clinging to, pushing away, or ignoring out of ignorance. So one choice is rooted in awareness. One choice is based in awareness, held within awareness, the turning towards. And the other is based in egoic fabrication, the habit to continue to create a self out of what is wanted or not wanted, or not seen, not known about.
Can you say that word again?
Fabrication, yeah. Creating, making up, yeah. And it is quite sobering to remember that while we're working within conditioned existence, while we're not awake to the point until we are awake, there's no neutral. So we're either moving towards in this way with awareness, or contracting against, which includes the clinging and the ignoring, but the sort of creating a self out of what's wanted and not wanted. There's no neutral ground. We're always creating fresh karma based on our choices. We don't get to just stop everything for a minute and rest. So, yeah, Lama Govinda, I've already mentioned him. He says, our minds can either bind us to this world of suffering or free us from it. Our mind can do both. Which capacity of the mind are we going to use? It can either bind us or free us.
Free.
Yeah. So you'll know this in your own experience, yeah? So some thoughts, words, and behaviors lead to contraction, tension, tightening, cutting off, alienation, suffering. Other thoughts, words, and actions lead to expansion, softening, opening, connecting, and ease of suffering. So we're a bit like sea anemones. Some of you have heard me use this metaphor before. I love it because it's so simple. And we really are that simple, which is also very humbling. So if you've ever gone tide pooling and you come across this beautiful, translucent, purpley, green, pinky thing, I don't even know what it is, an animal, I suppose. And it's just open, it's totally open. And it's just very gently kind of swaying in the tide. And then I don't know about you, but what I tend to want to do is poke it. And then it goes like that, doesn't it? Yeah, it just closes right up. Even before you actually come into contact, it'll feel the change in the water and it'll close. So that's how we are. We're either opening or closing. So I just want to say, this might be a slightly controversial thing to say, and it could be misunderstood. So you just have to roll it around in your minds. But, you know, there's no value judgment here when we're talking about karma. There's no right or wrong. There's no good or bad. I was raised Catholic, so I've got really strong conditioning around, like, being a good girl and being a bad girl. And unfortunately, I was often a bad girl. But I was just being me. Yeah, so it's not about that. We have to be willing. One of the things that we're trying to do in our practice is to expand our bandwidth for complexity. We have to be willing to not know and for there to be a lot of nuance. What one person does could be completely unskillful, whereas the other person does it and it's absolutely fine. Why is that? So it's about how we use our energy and whether the way we use it is in the service of awakening or in the service of delusion. So it's just the way the universe works for some reason.
You said expand our bandwidth on...
For complexity. So, yeah, so it's just the way the universe works. I don't know why. Sadhanandi has a really good theory about it. I can't remember what it is, because when she said it to me, it just went right over my head. Clearly, I'm not ready for that level of complexity. But it's just the way the universe works. You act skillfully, and suffering and happiness follows. You act unskillfully, and suffering falls. It's just the way it is. I suppose it could be the other way around. Maybe in some other universe, it's the other way around. I don't know. No, it's not. Thank you. That's what Sanandi did.
Same universe, same principles.
Same universe, same principles. Thank you. Okay, so... so we've got what we've got. We've got our conditioning. And we can use it. And start using our understanding of the law of karma to make it work for us. So maybe up until now, the law of karma, it hasn't been working for us because we've been acting out of delusion and we keep suffering. It's like that definition of insanity. You know, you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. So we've got our conditioning. And the good news is that we can start using our understanding of the law of karma to make it work for us, bringing those two things together. So this would be a good time to remind us of the Four Noble Truths. Does anyone want to have a go?
Thank you.
There is suffering.
There is suffering, yes.
Suffering has a cause.
Yes, there's a cause of suffering. And what's the cause of suffering?
Craving.
Yes. What else?
And there is a path that leads us from suffering.
Yes. What are the other causes of suffering? So craving.
Aversion.
Yeah, aversion.
And delusion.
And ignorance, yeah. And what particular kind of ignorance are we talking about here?
Not seeing reality.
Okay, get more specific. What are we particularly ignorant about?
Conditionality.
Conditionality, impermanence.
Our part. My part.
Your part, yeah, you're getting a bit closer there.
My responsibility.
Yeah, good.
Our own light, infinite light.
Ooh,
see it.
That's a poetic way of putting it. We think we have a self that is operating in there somewhere. A little person, a little us driving. Yeah, a fixed sense of self. And the flip side of that is that we're separate. Yeah, so we don't see the truth of interconnectedness. That's the root delusion. Okay, and then there's freedom from suffering. And then what else?
Way out of suffering.
What?
Way out of suffering.
Way out. Yes, thank you. There's a path that leads from suffering, and what's that path? Yes, you've been well trained. Yeah, I'm not going to ask who can list the Eightfold Path. Don't worry. Okay, we could probably do it collectively, but I need to keep an eye on time. You can look it up. So we know, I guess this is sort of the main exhortation. Is that the right word? I don't know. We know that we don't want to suffer. That's really clear to us, isn't it? We know that. We don't want to suffer. Nobody wants to suffer. And we want to be happy. So what's the problem? Let's go, yeah? Let's make it happen. Okay, so how do we do it? So I mentioned this illusion of self. So I just want you to check in with yourself. Do you think it's possible in this lifetime to see through the illusion of a fixed self? Just check right now. You don't have to think about it. What's the initial?
Can you repeat that question?
You don't have to answer me. Just make your own mental note. Do you think it's possible in this lifetime to see through the illusion of self?
Yes.
And then also, yeah. And then also, what thoughts or questions are coming up for you in relation to that material? So not just yes or no, but then what thoughts and questions emerge as you begin to reflect on that?
Okay, can you cite these two questions again?
Yeah, so do you think it's possible to wake up from the illusion of a fixed self in this lifetime? And by the way, Bhante said it was. Exactly. We should, if we are practicing diligently, it should be totally possible to wake up to the illusion of self in this lifetime. It's one of the first of the three fetters, the first three fetters. It's one of the first three fetters out of the 10. So it's a very early, within the whole process of awakening, it's an early fetter. And what thoughts or questions come up for you in relation to that material? Okay, so I want to just say a bit about working with karma in meditation. So here's another quote from Sangracha. This is from Know Your Mind. As one's mind is, so is one's karma. As one's karma is, so is one's rebirth. And if you don't believe in rebirth in terms of lifetimes, you could just think so is one's re-becoming in every moment of this life. As one's rebirth is, so is one's happiness or one's suffering. And ultimately, with the attainment of enlightenment, One is freed even from the alternation between happiness and suffering. The Buddhist tradition sums the whole matter up in one key phrase: actions have consequences. All this depends on the mind and mental events. If you want to get down to the root of what's going on, you need to look into your own mind. What is going on there? Mind and mental events. So we've been doing a lot of mindfulness of breathing and metta bhavana on this retreat in the mornings. So one thing you could get curious about is your mental states within the context of those practices. So if you're able to establish enough absorption, it should be easy enough to begin to turn towards what is arising in your mind. The third foundation of mindfulness: thoughts and emotions. Body, feelings, vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, thoughts and emotions, dhammas. I'll say more about dhammas in a minute. So in our meditation, we are opening and bringing awareness to our karmic inheritance as it is manifesting as volitions or samskaras, patterns, habits that shape our sense of self. So we're waking up to what all of our conditioning has given rise to in that moment. Any thought or emotion that's arising will be something that you're inheriting karmically as a volition or samskara. So in the clarity of our mind, we can watch the whole thing just play out as objects appearing in a mirror or scenes on a film reel. So what's happening there? So I'll just say a little bit about sort of technically what's going on. So we've already heard a bit on this retreat about the senses, so I want to say a bit more. So we've got the six senses, yeah? So we've got the five traditional senses, and we've got the mind, thoughts, and emotions. So objects come in. We can't stop that. We're just these deeply sensitive little small wet miracles. Not that small or wet anymore, but we're still here. We're still miracles. So all that's coming in. And then what's happening is, and you'll know this, this is hopefully not new for you. So it's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, right? So there's either an initial experience of that as not very pleasant, experience of it as pleasant, or not really sure, or it's a bit numb. And then we react accordingly out of habit. So the habit will be, again, based on your own unique concoction of conditioning, to pull something towards, oh yes, like that, that's all of, that is me, that is how I am, that is who I am, that's how it should be. To push away, oh no, don't like that, that's not who I am, that's not how it should be. Or just complete sort of numbing out or confusion or doubt or indecision, not so sure, not really care, not that interested. So I want to say a little bit about the kleshas. So this is the territory that we're getting into now. So the kleshas, root poisons, what we're working to transform. The good news about the kleshas is if they weren't there, there'd be nothing to transform. So when they arise, we could just be really excited. Great. Now I can transform this. So the world is the world of suffering, the world we inhabit, our world, runs on the kleshas, is fueled by, fed by the kleshas. And it doesn't take much imagination, particularly just now, to see this, yeah? It's everywhere. And I would really encourage you to find language that works for you. So there's lots of different words. So I'll just give you some options. Greed, craving, wanting, grasping, pulling towards, desire, greed, craving, wanting, grasping, pulling towards desire. So again, come up with your own language, whatever works for you. Hatred, ill will, aversion, not wanting, pushing away, rejection, delusion, ignorance, confusion, doubt, not knowing, not caring, not interested. And then I want to add a couple more. So there's lots of different lists. So those three are the three that are at the center of the Wheel of Life. And then there's expansions upon the theme.
Can you say the last one again?
Yeah. Delusion, ignorance, confusion, doubt, not knowing, not caring, not interested. And then I want to add a couple more, which are personal favorites. They're both in the territory of conceit. So pride, egoic overinflation, big-headedness, overvaluing the self construct, self-centeredness, thinking one is better than others, smarter than, better looking, better fashion sense. And then, of course, the flip side of that, jealousy or envy, egoic deflation, undervaluing the self-conflict. Both of these fall within the realm of comparison. Thinking one is less than others, not as good as. And the reason why I want to bring these in is because they will come up on retreat. They come up on retreat. So let's just acknowledge that. It's here. Let's work with it together. Let's support each other to work with that. So in both meditation and as we go about our daily lives, we can use the four right efforts to work creatively with the kleshas. So I just want to name these really helpful way and concise way of thinking about how we work with mental states. So the first is to remove an unskillful mental state that has arisen. The second is to prevent further unhelpful mental states from arising. The third, so the first, remove, the second, prevent. The third, maintain and develop skillful mental states. And the fourth, to bring into being further skillful mental states. So remove unskillful mental states, prevent further proliferation of unskillful mental states, maintain skillful mental states, and bring into being further skillful mental states. So I just want to say something about this first one, removing unskillful mental states that have arisen. I don't know if you have the game Operation here. We have that in the States. So it's like this plastic body and you could kind of like go in and pick things up and take them out. So it's not really like that with unskillful mental states, unfortunately. You can't just prod yourself with a set of pliers and pull them out. So I asked Bhante. I'd just come off my ordination retreat. It was the first time I was meeting with him, and I was feeling very sure of myself, let's say. And I felt that I was ready for the higher teaching on what to do with anger, and I was sure that he would give it to me. So I went to see him, and I asked him, you know, what's the higher teaching on how to work with anger? And he just looked at me and he said, well, you just bring awareness to it. And I said, I know. That's what I've been doing. I know you just bring awareness to us. But then what do you do? And he looked at me and he said, you just bring awareness to it. So one question we could ask ourselves is, do I believe awareness is enough? Do I trust that my awareness is enough? That awareness is enough to transform whatever arises within it. Do I believe that awareness is enough? Another thing that happened in that same meeting, I had taken the Padmasambhava sadhana. And Padmasambhava, those of you who are familiar with Padmasambhava, he has this wrathful smile, which is quite a koan, to smile wrathfully. it's worth doing, actually. You just do it in the mirror, you know, practice your wrathful smile. So I said to Bhante, can you say a bit more about the wrathful smile? Because I don't really understand what's going on there. And he said, oh, yes, he smiles like that because he delights in destroying the unskillful. He said it very sort of like that. And I hated it. I hated what he'd said. There was so much resistance. I didn't like the language of destruction. I thought it was a pat answer. I wanted him to say more. And I went away very unsatisfied with that part of the conversation. But the good news is that I took notes right away and wrote everything down so I could go back and reflect on it. And I have reflected on it a lot. And I think what he was... So what I have gotten out of that over years of practicing with it is... you know, there's something about seeing really clearly the suffering, our own suffering. It's actually worth every time you're in a moment of suffering to just pause and put your hand wherever you might be feeling that contraction and just say, oh, this is a moment of suffering. This is a moment of suffering. And seeing that we've created that, you know, we've created that. It may not be all the time. So if you're in physical pain, you get knocked down by a truck, for example. But how are you with that? You know, is there resistance? So this is a moment of suffering. Can we begin to turn towards this moment of suffering? And see the promise of liberation inherent in that moment of suffering. Relate to it from a point of view of, if I could be with this in with enough love and awareness, what is possible there? And one thing I have seen is that in the clear light of awareness, any illusion of self cannot be sustained and something else becomes possible. So by seeing that moment of suffering, seeing clearly my own unskillfulness in creating that moment of suffering, so I'm just talking about on the karmic level right now. If there is something I've done, unskillful action, that's created that moment of suffering, can I be with that enough to allow it to shift and change and for something else to emerge? So when Bhante says he delights in destroying the unskillful, it's because in that moment of the unskillful being fully seen in light of awareness, something else happens and it's delightful what happens there. So we're pulling up something from the root, pulling it up from the root.
Can I ask?
Yes.
A question, just living this as you're talking, thank you. So what happens sometimes for me comes shame.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
Oh, good.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so bring awareness to it. Yeah, bring awareness to it. It's always the same thing, bring awareness to it. I mean, we've got lots of tools. So like Vajrasattva, for example, is really helpful with shame. So bringing to mind Buddhas or Bodhisattvas that can help sit with us in that fire, and also resting back. So sometimes, you know, we can also misunderstand that the teaching is to like get a crowbar and pry everything open. Like, I gotta be aware of it all. But actually, yeah, if shame comes up, it's gonna need a lot of space and time. And then we have to be very patient with that process. And that might be your practice for however long that takes.
Thank you.
Yeah.